Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Hello, Bristol, and welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping us review this week's news is Conservative Councillor for Henbury, Mark Weston. Robin Clapp from the Bristol and District Anti-Cuts Alliance is here too. In the second hour after six, the old South Bristol College site on Marksbury Road in Bedminster looks set to have its thriving local community groups and small businesses told to leave in February, even though the council has no plans for it. So why are our community-owned buildings not for the community anymore? Plus, an old soldier from World War II asks the British Army to reinstate a Polish officer 65 years after he was sacked, and he believes scapegoated in September 1944, blamed for the famous failure of the Bridge Too Far operation in Arnhem. That's all in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 13 Celsius and dry this weekend, up to 21, some hazy sunshine on Saturday and sunny spells on Sunday, interspersed, I'm afraid, with heavy showers. So if you want to go out and not get wet, I think you have to do it tomorrow. Next week, highs of 20, fairly wet at the beginning of the week with some heavy showers, sunnier though towards the end of the week. That's next weekend, that's the 18th and 19th of August. Highs again, 20 Celsius, sunny spells, and still some showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, like a bad smell, it lingers on. I'm talking, I'm afraid, about the matter of Filton and Bradley Stoke MP Jack Lopresti's live promise back in May to supply this show with a copy of the Bristol Freemasons annual provincial yearbook. Well, it's got the names of Bristol's 2,000 or so Freemasons in the city's 50 or so lodges. For those that missed it, here is Jack and the promise he made back in May.
To go and visit Freemasons Hall in Bristol or one of the Freemasons Halls in South Gloucestershire, and you'll see, you know, it's a positive organisation which does a lot of good work for local charities.
I tell you one thing I might ask you is for the book, the little book for the Bristol Masonic book, which has got actually the names of who it is, because that's why people, I think, mostly question Freemasonry, because they don't know who the Masons are.
There are lots of organisations which don't publicise their membership, and that we can have a debate about, you know, how much that should be transparent. But if you want, I'll send you a copy.
Lovely.
Of that. It's interesting. It's like a play. You know, there's nothing remotely sinister about it. And with the internet, you can find out probably more about Freemasonry than the average Freemason would ever learn in his lifetime.
Okay. Now on to Filton.
So I'll send you the book and I'll arrange a visit.
Thank you, Jack. Well, 3 months on now, several letters to Jack Lopresti's office and the Bristol Masons at the bottom of Park Street, as well as phone calls, but not a sausage. Well, just imagine if our chief constable or a candidate for mayor or police and crime commissioner's names were in that little book. So, if you have access to a copy of the Bristol Freemasons provincial yearbook with all their names in, or if you know a disgruntled Mason who wants to spill the beans, you know what to do. Well, on to today, and helping us review this week's news is Conservative Councillor for Henbury, Mark Weston. Hi, Mark. Welcome to Drive Time.
Good evening. Thank you for having me.
Now, I wonder, are you one of those types of Conservatives that think that the city should be run like a business? This is one of the things I'm hearing around the city now, a lot from Lib Dems, some of them, and also from some Conservatives, is the trouble with the city is people don't run it like a business. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think you first have to say, what kind of business... we've seen throughout history various different businesses run in whole different ways. I think in some ways the city should be like a business. In fact, it should be efficient and give value for money to the taxpayer. But you've also seen businesses that have acted in a pretty disreputable way. You know, Barclays and the LIBOR and all the rest of it. So I definitely don't want the city running like that.
But well, we've seen HSBC doing money laundering for Mexican drug cartels, haven't we? I mean, there are quite a few businesses. I mean, for example,
accusations, yeah.
the Murdoch. Well, this is an accusation. Yeah. This has actually been proven by the US Senate Investigative Committee about that on that particular incident about HSBC. I mean, then we've got the sort of Murdoch empire and the idea that a business uses its money for political power and influence.
Yeah, I don't think anyone's suggesting that we should run the city like Murdoch Empire. But the city should be run efficiently, and the city should be value for money, and it should be delivering services at a good price to those that use it.
But isn't the most efficient way of running something where the shareholders aren't taking their cut? You know, I mean, that's what happens in a business, is the business is run for the benefit and the profit of the shareholders, not for the people who are using the service the business is providing.
Well, the shareholders, if you run the city like a business, the shareholders then are all the residents that actually live in the city, and they will be rewarded if the city's run like a business, if this run efficiently, and they get value for money for the council tax.
So do you see the elections a bit like an AGM, you know, where the shareholders can come along and say, right, we've had enough of this chief executive, we've had enough of these people?
Well, you can't get rid of the chief executive. You will be able to now, obviously, there's going to be mayor elections, so you almost be deciding who's going to be the very top of the pyramid, where before you didn't. So in some ways, I think that is a good thing. But yeah, elections, I think elections should be all-out elections, and that when we go to the polls, we should be able to, you know, fire the whole council, not just a third of it. You know, this kind of death by a thousand cuts, because if the council's not doing its job, then the residents and local people should be able to just get rid of the
but,
whole
I mean, that's a different argument, isn't it, about the elections and the timing of the elections.
No, you brought up the fact you wanted to be like a board and can't get rid of the board.
Well, I didn't say that. I mean, that's just one way. Yeah. But I mean, ultimately, the philosophy of a business, how is it different? Or, you know, the money-making for the shareholders, how is that different from the way the city should be run, if at all?
Well, the thing is, if you look at a business, the business runs best when they are not bureaucratic. Yeah, when processes are free and easy, they can flow, ideas flow up and down the command chain. And I think sometimes our government gets too stuck in this idea of backroom costs. And you've seen this whenever you're looking at comparisons about what, say, third sector, you know, charities can do and what the council can do. Invariably, the charities can do it cheaper than the council. And I think one of the reasons for that is they have less bureaucracy. So, yeah, I think actually the council can take some lessons from business and it can be run more efficiently. But obviously, you don't want to run it like a crooked business.
What about the idea that, where do, so for example, the elderly feature in that business model? Because, I mean, the elderly, you simply just have to spend money on them. You can't expect them to be productive. And the same with, say, for example, drug addicts or mental patients. I mean, talking about the damaged and the vulnerable in society. Where do they fit into the business model?
Well, the thing is, I mean, the elderly and everyone, every vulnerable person should be taken care of as best that you can. But there needs to be realism, the fact that there isn't a bottomless pit that you can continually fund things from. I wish there were. And particularly if you look at the population we've got at the moment, and we are getting older, we are living longer, that does pose some quite demographic problems. But you have to do your best, you have to run council efficiently, and where possible you need to make sure the maximum amount of money flows to frontline services that protect those vulnerable groups, but also provide services to the rest of us.
Well, you say there isn't a bottomless pit, but there's apparently, as we were hearing a couple of weeks ago from The Guardian, £21 trillion out there in tax havens, which is a way the tax man can't get his hands on any of that. And if he was to be able to, this is wealth owned by British people, there would be something like £70 billion extra every year for the government to spend, because those savings would be being taxed.
Yeah, but if you actually look, the government is trying to close those tax havens down, and or at least limit them anyway. There was a deal with Switzerland earlier in the year so that more information and more tax revenues can flow back into the coffers. I mean, the $21 trillion is probably a guesstimate. I haven't seen how those figures
It's the tax the Tax Justice Network put it together.
As far as I'm concerned, no one should be trying to tax dodge at all. And there was a big scandal about this, of who's doing what and where and how. You know, society is run by taxes. Now, as a Conservative, I think those taxes should be as low as they possibly can. You should be as efficient as you possibly can, but you should still be paying them.
Can we really expect the Cabinet to legislate for changes in tax havens when Ian Cameron, his David Cameron's father, was one of the pioneers of the use of tax havens, putting their family wealth in Panama and the Cayman Islands back in the 1980s? And also, we've got a Cabinet of millionaires. You know, these are the people who keep much of their wealth in these tax havens.
Yeah.
I noticed on Question Time about 2 months ago, Ken Clark saying with a slight red face, oh yes, I think we really must do something about tax havens, and the knowledge that of course he's got much of his wealth, personal wealth, in these tax havens.
Well, the thing is, some of the tax havens are actually being closed, and the loopholes you access them are being closed. But afraid you can't just make it an issue that this government needs to deal with. You've had 13 years of a Labour government, and we're in the problem we are now, and we're still using predominantly the tax system that they were using. This is an issue that all party government needs to tackle and needs to close down. I'm sure you would agree with that as well.
Right. What about your mayoral candidate? Because I understand the Conservative group on the City Council has chosen who they want to put forward as a candidate for mayor this year.
Well, we had a meeting of the membership, and that was on Tuesday. And yes, we're putting forward Councillor Geoffrey Gollop.
So why do you think Jeff's been chosen?
I think Jeff's an exceedingly good councillor. He's a good Bristol boy, born, bred here, educated here, businessman here. He's got a track record as an accountant. You know, he knows fully how to manage funds and how to get the best value for money out of them, and I think he'd be good in charge of the council's budget. Because remember, when the elections happen on November 15th, 2 weeks later, you're going to be starting to put forward a £1 billion budget, and so we're going to be voting for the person who's going to be administering and running services on that budget, and I think Jeff's eminently qualified.
I mean, you know, accountants don't tend to be the most sort of charismatic types, visionary types. I mean, do we really want an accountant running the city?
I'm sorry, I think you've made a gross generalisation of accountants there. I think you're believing the press on it. Jeff is a good guy, he's a funny guy, he's a charismatic guy, he's got a track record, he'll be good for the city.
OK, I'm also joined by Robin Clapp from the Bristol and District Anti-Cuts Alliance. Hi, Robin. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, Tony.
Now, your thoughts this week about some of the economic figures we've had through. We've had a rather devastating announcement by Mervyn King Wednesday, I think it was, or Thursday this week, saying that it looks like now that there will be no growth. So what does that tell us about what's going on in our economy? Well, I mean, this is also sort of under the cover of the Olympics, isn't it? It's a convenient time to announce such a dreadful... So we've had nearly two and a half years of this Conservative Lib Dem coalition, and now we've come actually back down to forecasts of zero growth.
Well, on the afternoon before the launch of the Olympics, Michael Gove managed to slip in an announcement saying that it will now be possible for academies to employ specialists who are not qualified teachers. So yes, the Olympics has been a lovely opportunity in the last couple of weeks to bury bad news. What the figures this week have shown is that exports are not growing, but just as significantly, imports are falling. And that is at least partly to do with the fact that small businesses in particular are receiving little or no help from the coalition, despite the quantitative easing that Mervyn King has introduced on several occasions. The money is not reaching small businesses, and just as importantly, is not reaching consumers. People are not going out to buy when there is an enormous uncertainty over whether they will have a job in 6 months' time, whether they will be able to continue enjoying the standard of living they have over the last period. And I think all three parties over the last 20 or 25 years have signed up to this idea that the market is infallible, that there's no alternative to letting neoliberalism and globalisation run amok. We saw in 2008 a wake-up call. Unfortunately, as always is the case, it's ordinary people who have to pay the price. And I very much agree with the point that was made earlier about the money that's being stored in tax havens. But also, just as importantly, I think, there is an estimated £2 billion or more not being spent because companies don't see a way to invest that money. In fact, I've underestimated the figure. It's over £250 billion is sitting in the coffers of big business and not being used. Yeah, well, so the money's there.
You've missed out a couple of noughts there, never mind. But anyway, Mark, what can you answer that? Why is it that there is this sort of lack of confidence? But one of the things that particularly annoys me is that all this quantitative easing is going into the banks, but then it's just hitting basically a brick wall. It's not getting through the banks. The banks are very reluctant, it seems, to lend. And this is being used to prop up these banks rather than actually to prop up the economy.
I think one of the problems that the economy has, and I think problems the banks have as well, is the banks being asked to do two things, and that is they need to lend more money and at the same time have more assets in case there's another financial storm on the horizon. And the problem is we know where that storm is coming from. It's the Eurozone, and we see it unfolding day by day. mean, on the 20th of this month, Greece will have to satisfy its international creditors that it's sticking to its austerity program, or they're going to pull the money. So actually, the 20th of August could be the point where this all hits the rocks. But businesses and the banks know that this is going to happen at some point. Now, I hate to say this, but in a lot of cases, like, you know, people listening today who are probably trying to save a bit more, put a bit more aside, they're not spending as much, it's because they know something is going to happen, and they've got to be prepared for it. Now, the banks are being helped by this quantitative easing, let's be brutally honest about it, but they're also being given the impossible task of saying, right, you need to have 11%, you know, assets in case there's a problem. Oh, by the way, lend more. Now, they can't do both. Now, I think what the government has is going to be doing is they're going to be borrowing at the low interest rates that we've still managed to keep because of AAA rating, $110 billion. And that has been given to the banks specifically, and they won't, in tranches, so they won't get the next tranche, as long as it goes straight to the businesses at good rates to try and get them to invest. But people are nervous. We know there are problems out there. But the thing is, we also need to be careful when we talk about the economy, because there aren't, it isn't all bad. Confidence is actually up in the latest forecasts. People are feeling a bit better in the business community, and also unemployment is dropping.
Okay, well, let's go now to, I mean, the cabinet are sort of slightly in the background over the summer. Parliament's in recess,
but
King Mervyn is still around, and King Mervyn spoke this week.
The economy will continue to face headwinds over the forecast period, from the fiscal consolidation and the tight credit conditions at home, as well as from the difficulties in the euro area and a broader slowing in the world economy. The recession in the euro area is damaging demand for our exports. A black cloud of uncertainty is hanging over investment, and the weakening euro is a further obstacle to the adjustment we need to make in our net trade position. Our efforts to bring about a rebalancing of the UK economy will require patience.
Well, black clouds gathering, Mark. It doesn't sound very positive, does he?
Well, no, I mean, it all comes back to, we know that there is a storm out there, and 50% of our trade, I think just a little bit less of a percent, crosses the channel and is traded with the Eurozone. Now, if the euro drops in value, our exports to it become less and less competitive because we have a stronger currency.
But, I mean, isn't there more to it than that? That really we should be thinking about having some kind of financial wall between us and the eurozone. Otherwise, when the eurozone goes down, it's going to be like a house of cards. The city's going to be, you know, literally facing the same kind of problems. It's going to be a collapse in the city as well.
Which is why the banks have been asked to recapitalise and hold these assets. You know, that's one of the reasons for it. We know it is going to happen. Now, the thing is, we are less exposed to Greek debt than the French and the Germans, but we're exposed to French and German debt because we lent them money that they lend on to the Greece. This is all a chain, and it feeds everywhere. We can't put in that wall. The problem has been systemic for 15, 20 years now. It has already happened. It's been like closing the stable doors after the horse is well and truly bolted, now, and then setting fire to the stable.
Robin, what are your thoughts then on this announcement? Because, I mean, we hear headwinds, black clouds gathering. I mean, it almost sounds like he's reading out a bit of poetry, even though he does it in a rather boring way, rather than talking about an economic forecast. We're using all these kind of, meteorological metaphors to describe what's going on. I mean, you know, I want to hear exactly what's going to happen. And he's saying, one of the things we didn't hear on that clip is King Mervyn is saying that we don't know what's going to happen, basically, because the eurozone is an unknown quantity. So in a way, he's holding up his hands and is saying, look, if anything really, really bad happens, don't blame me.
I think that the situation with the euro is very grim, and obviously there is now a general acknowledgement that the European Union project, and in particular the euro project, is facing peril, and in all probability there will be a Greek exit from the euro at some stage, quite possibly followed by other countries' exit. However, it's too glib and too easy to talk about the British crisis as being a consequence of the situation with the euro. The British crisis predates the euro. We've had 25 or 30 years of deindustrialization in this country. One of the principal reasons why British exports are not competitive is we don't make things anymore. the City of London became a financial world centre, and successive governments, from Margaret Thatcher through John Major through Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, all believed that the City of London was the goose that laid the golden egg. The crash in 2008 woke them up, and they're now facing the consequence of a city which, on the one hand, they can't let go of because they see it as being an extremely valuable resource, but on the other hand, the quantitative easing and Mervyn King's warnings indicate that Britain is very ill prepared. When you have a Chancellor of the Exchequer who continually beats his breast and says he will try 110% to get things right, first of all, I think it's a bit silly to talk about 110%. I think if the Chancellor believes there's such a figure, he should go back to school and do some proper maths. But secondly, and more importantly, the Coalition clearly does not know what is happening and what to do about it. The money that's being released to the banks, allegedly to try and entice them to invest, won't result in investment because the banks don't see a market. They don't see a domestic market, and given the uncertainties surrounding the euro, don't see a future market as well. And this is a world crisis, Tony. The Chinese economy is slowing down, the Indian economy is slowing down, but we have a government which is dazzled by these problems and incapable and in fact ideologically unwilling to consider actually utilising the unused labour of unemployed people to create schemes of work based on decent wages, to build homes, to build hospitals. Instead, we have a government that's selling everything off, because if the private sector won't invest, the only thing the government can do to try and keep the profitability high is to sell off, to flog off the public sector and let people like Richard Branson make money out of our health service. And that's what they're doing at the moment, instead of creating jobs for ordinary people.
I don't know where to begin with that one. All right. Let's be quite clear about this. The problem we have in Britain at the moment is we have a massive, massive deficit and a colossal burden of debt. We have borrowed too much for too long. And at some point, as everyone knows who's listening to this, if you're running your domestic accounts, if you continually borrow, at some point people call in. You have to pay back. Now, I wouldn't mind. In a standard economic cycle, what you do is you put money aside when in the good years, so it allows you to borrow and you pay down debt so you can borrow when the bad years come. And we didn't. We had an 11% structural deficit. You know, the government itself was bringing in all the tax revenues, it's all its income, $541 billion. But they were spending $700 billion. That is totally uneconomic. That doesn't add up. So your idea that they can make jobs and make money, the only way they can do that is by borrow more and more and more and more money. But the problem is the markets. Where does that money come from? It comes from banks and pension funds. It comes from the Chinese government. It comes from all these other sources. And they're getting cagey about who they lend it to. If they don't believe that you're actually going to be able to pay that money back in the end, then they'll stop. And this is why Spain and Italy are now having to borrow at 7%, which is totally unjustifiable and totally unmaintainable over the long run. But they do believe Britain is going to be able to pay it back, which is why we still get low rates. So while the deficit's dropping down, they are still willing to lend us that money. There isn't this bottomless pit of cash.
No, and I mean, one of the other things about all this, Mark, is that it might be possible that the debt burden gets so great, as it is in the United States, that it looks like it will never be paid off, at which point you just have to simply write the debt off, don't you?
Well, we'll find that one out soon enough, because America's debt will theoretically put the government totally out of business in 2032. But that is the point where no one will.
The thing is,
the banks
can actually extend the terms of the loan longer and longer and longer, and build up masses and masses of debt. At some point, they say, "Well, look, you now owe us. You're never going to be able to pay us back. Therefore, we're just going to have to cancel the debt." Although the banks don't want to do that, that's simply what has to happen in a market situation. Surely,
to a point, yeah. But this money isn't just coming from the banks. This is, the Chinese government are one of the biggest purchasers, if not the largest purchaser of foreign debt. Now, I mean, we were chatting before the show, but Hank Paulson said when he visited Beijing in 2008, he was having a chat with his Chinese counterpart, and the Chinese counterpart said that they were concerned about all the money that they'd lent to Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, these big mortgage houses in America, and that would he give them assurance that these billions would be repaid? He said yes. And then the Chinese said, because we took a phone call from the Russians that said, well, why don't we coordinate and dump billions and billions and billions of pounds of all this debt on the market and collapse the American economy? Having too much debt is a threat to stability. You've got to pay the money back or the market won't lend it to you.
I think Marx tried to tell us the Tories' usual story that Britain has a huge debt and therefore we all have to pay it. In historical terms, Britain's debt levels are low. And what
compared to World
War II. We never hear from the Tories is one of the reasons why the deficit is so high is because after the collapse of Lehman Brothers in 2008, there needed to be a desperate rescue act which led to a huge amount of public money being spent to bail out the very banks that got us in the mess in the first place. Coupled with rising unemployment and a double dip recession, we now have less taxation coming into the exchequer. Now, we're all being told that the deficit has to be paid. Now, it's completely different dealing with a national or international economy than it is dealing with a family household. It's insulting to people to say that you run a country in terms of living in a surplus. If every country in the world has a surplus, think about it. How does that add up? George Osborne didn't understand that in 2010 when he said we all need to get a surplus. The truth is the Tories are taking us into a deeper recession. The IMF have castigated the policies of this coalition government. The IMF, in very polite language, it's true, because a lot of them went to the same schools as David Cameron and Nick Clegg, don't like to be too insulting, perhaps aren't as blunt as myself, but nevertheless have warned the Tories that there is no way forward. And unless the coalition start thinking about putting investment into useful public works and taking some of the measures that were taken to bring Britain out of previous recessions, there will be a massive crash. And this AAA rating that we hear about, it's so important we keep the AAA rating. Well, I've news from Mark. Some of the rating agencies are on the brink of taking away Britain's AAA rating because they're looking at the underlying weakness of the British economy and they're saying, with or without the euro, inside or outside of the European Union, Britain is systemically weak as an industrial power now.
Okay, before I let Mark reply, Mark, it's really a bit cheeky of you here. I'm going to let your boss hear what he had to say this week about the economy. That is the Chancellor of Exchequer, George Osborne.
Well, it's very disappointing news, and it is a very tough economic situation when you're recovering from these enormous debts that Britain built up in the good years. That's not made any easier by the fact that much of Europe is in recession or heading into recession. And we've got to go on dealing with those debts, making our businesses more competitive so that they can create jobs, helping young people get into work, and making sure that we don't deliberately add to borrowing, don't deliberately spend more and make a difficult situation even worse.
Well, I would agree with that. I mean, it's quite interesting, actually. The solution there, it seems from my colleague we're hearing before, Chancellor of the Exchequer, who isn't quite my boss, I might be on a higher pay grade, but what we're saying is that the bailout of the banks in 2008 was a bad thing, and yet before that we heard that actually what we need to do is spend money to create jobs. There are 1 million people that are actually employed by the financial services. If you start letting the banks go to the wall and collapse, first of all, you imperil those jobs, but you also imperil all of our mortgages and all of the credit that we've relied on. You know, it's not just been the government that's borrowed too much for too long. We all have. I have. And we've got to get that right. And at some point, you have to pay down debt. Now, the AAA credit rating is important because you need to keep borrowing while the deficit goes down. But unemployment is falling. You know, it's the only probably bit of good economic news that's coming out of it.
Robin, have you got a reply to that? I mean, it sounds like actually at least we're heading in the right direction.
The point about the banks that I was trying to make, as Mark well knows, is that the bailout in 2008 was a consequence of the reckless policies of successive Tory and Labour governments, which gave the City of London the green light to make money, to engage in the derivatives market, to invent all these exotic instruments which bore no relationship to real production and real wealth. And the consequence of that is that Brown, whom I hold no torch for, had to bail out Lehman Brothers,
costing the Exchequer an enormous amount of money. So the banks, who are culpable for this crisis, have got off scot-free. I think one of them's had his knighthood taken away. But apart from that, the same people who brought us into this mess are in the City of London today. And I'm not talking about the people who work in the City of London. Many of them lost their jobs as well when Lehman's went belly up. Many of them may lose their job if Standard Charter have their license taken away, or HSBC is found to have been engaged in money laundering, as has been alleged. But the point is that if we continue to allow the banks in the City of London to act in the reckless, unregulated manner that they have grown accustomed to for the last 25 years, then this crisis will be one in a number of subsequent crises. And it's always us. It's always the people who pay. It's not David Cameron. It's not the Chancellor of the Exchequer. Cameron says young people won't be able to get social housing. There's no housing. If they're unemployed, they have to live with their families until they're 35. I don't know how many rooms he has in his house. My children can't live in my house, in a two-bedroom house. What kind of future have these banks destroyed? Mark and others may say, you know, it's going to get better. Britain's outside the euro. Thank goodness we're not affected by the euro in the same way as Greece and Spain. The point I am trying to make is this system, the capitalist system, has brought us to a reckless place. And in the 21st century, do we really want to continue living like this? Well, or is it not time to say we need to take these people into public ownership and have banks that act for the people rather than for themselves and their shareholders?
Okay, there's a lot of stuff in there, Robin, but one thing I'd just like you to answer, if you can, is this whole point is of the banks being bailed out by us, the taxpayer, and yet actually the people who seems having to pay for it are the most vulnerable in society. That just doesn't seem fair on a sort of very, very basic human level, Mark Weston.
Let's be quite... Try to phrase this properly. All right, the banks got bailed out, and they got bailed out by the taxpayer because they needed to at the time. Okay, all members of society, anyone that pays tax, is obviously affected by that bailout. But you are right; those that have the least money are the ones that are going to be most affected because they're the least able to cope with the storm when it comes along. Now you need to create a system, and I think my colleague and I would agree, where this doesn't happen again. You can't let it happen again. And there was a telling part, I think, was in the American Treasury Select Committee, when they were saying if, for example, the LIBOR scandal, and that happened in America, the bankers would go to jail. And in Britain, what, they have a knighthood removed?
Well, no, he's still in the cabinet, isn't he? Lord Green, the guy who was the chairman of HSBC whilst this money laundering was going on. I mean, what has happened to our politicians is that it seems that nothing will convince them that they've done something wrong and that they should resign. Even if you've been in charge of a bank that's been laundering billions of pounds for the Mexican drug cartels, who leave piles of bodies by the side of the road of people they don't like.
I agree. I mean, I think we might actually find something we agree on here. As far as I'm concerned, if you've been carrying out such massive malpractice, if you've been laundering money for drug cartels, then there is a criminal charge that you need to answer on that. And I think these bankers, rather than they have to pay like a bit of bonus back, that they should actually be handed over to the police. In America, they'd face jail time. In Britain, they should as well.
Well, I mean, surely
there should not be a situation where an action has little consequence. The banks need to be not over-regulated, but properly regulated, and there need to be criminal charges for when they mess up.
Okay, well, finally on this subject, which we always do to in about half an hour trying to pull apart at the start of the show, Angela Merkel is running the Fourth Reich. Fury in Germany after a Berlusconi newspaper prints a picture of the German Chancellor with her hand raised and compares her government to the Nazis. The newspaper also suggested two world wars and millions of dead was not enough to quieten German egomania. Now, Robin, maybe you on this first. Do you think this is just a little bit of xenophobia, or is there any truth to it? Because certainly the German... I mean, we were hearing from Mervyn King that we've got much of Europe in recession, or actually, maybe it was George Osborne just now. But the Germans are doing very well out of it all.
Well, it was probably George Osborne and Mervyn King. They both agree we're in a recession. The similarity extends into them not really knowing what to do about it.
But the point being, not the Germans, they're doing quite nicely.
But Berlusconi's comments about Angela Merkel are linked to the fact that he's looking to make a political recovery. Berlusconi is thinking about another chance at going for
the prime ministership of Italy with his party in the next election. So it was a cheap jibe. It obviously is ludicrous in terms of trying to suggest that Merkel is in any way linked to fascism. However, there is an issue here, which is that the Euro project has been very, very, very beneficial for German big business and for German industry. And the flaw within the Euro project, which people like myself saw from the outset, and perhaps Mark and many others did as well, was if you put together a number of economies, all of which are at different stages of development, all of which have different productivities of labour and so on, and you tie the weaker economies to a currency which is not able to float and thereby give you opportunity to boost your exports by having cheaper exports, then the most productive economy, the richest economy, will grow and benefit. And that's what's happened in the Euro. And
okay, let me just ask Mark then. Mark Weston, you're a Conservative councillor in the city in Henbury. What are your thoughts about this comment by the Berlusconi paper saying that Merkel is running the Fourth Reich?
Well, I have to say, actually, I think I agree with most of what my colleague just said, so maybe there'll be an outbreak of love in the room. No, it is blatantly a political thing by Berlusconi. He is after making a comeback.
But about this aspect to it all, where the German businesses are doing really well out of all this?
Well, of course they are. The thing is, and you know, we all saw this coming on the Eurozone, but you know, I told you so isn't an economic policy. The fact is, you tied 17 countries together, which was never going to work. So the EU's own study on this found that the Germans have got 1-2% more efficient and benefited each year. And of course, it's been around now for 10 years. So that builds up into a massive headwind. And the Greeks have got 1-2% less efficient. So you have German banks lending money to the Greek government, Greek people, to then buy German goods. And you've got this circle that was always destined to spiral down. I mean, as far as I can see, the only thing that can help the euro now is actually probably Germany leaving it, because at least that way the rest of the euro would devalue.
Okay,
Germany is too strong for the current waters it's swimming in.
Great idea. I think you're probably right there. Anyway, on to our next story. And UK inquiry criticises conditions at the Irish Investors Care Home. This is from the Irish Times. An English private hospital group owned by Irish investors, led by former Kerry Group Chief Executive Dennis Brosnan, where dozens of patients were ill-treated by staff at one of its hospitals near Bristol, pursued profit over humane treatment. A major inquiry has declared 11 former staff at the now closed Winterbourne View care home in Bristol for adults with autism and learning difficulties have pleaded guilty to beating patients, dousing them in water and encouraging some to consider suicide. They will be sentenced next month. Now, Robin Clapp from the Bristol and District's Anti-Cuts Alliance, what does this teach us about the way our care homes are being run in this country?
Well, obviously, it's a horrific story, and we have to commend the BBC's Panorama programme for being prepared to unearth this story and bring it before the attention of ordinary people. I fear it's not an isolated case. I fear that in the private sector, because of the driving down of wages, the competition between different care providers to try and establish a larger share of the market, that this kind of thing will happen again. Now, I'm not saying that there aren't irregularities within the public sector on occasions either. The difference is that these private firms are largely unregulated. There are not sufficient numbers of people going around checking these firms. Many of the elderly people in these care homes are unable or unwilling to voice their own concerns or inform third parties about ill treatment that perhaps they are receiving. And, you know, this comes in the week after Bristol City Council's cabinet agreed to press ahead with the closure and privatisation of its day centres and care homes. And the Anti-Cuts Alliance, which steadfastly opposes this step, will be, over the course of the next 2 to 3 months, organising a series of exposés across the city to show what the privatisation and closure of local authority care homes will mean for not only vulnerable elderly people presently in them, but for many, many families who will now face the very real anxiety about where they're going to relocate their elderly relatives, whether it will be in a private care home, whether some of these elderly relatives will be brought back into the home environment, and that will be very difficult because the facilities often don't exist now to have local authority help. So it's a horrible example, but in my view,
it is indicative of what happens when you privatise services, you put profit before need, and you take the view that you're going to let private shareholders provide services which currently are provided very ably by Bristol City Local Authority, and which many, many people who have used those services say are excellent services. So
okay.
I think it's a terrible thing, but it's not going to be the only case we hear about.
Mark, Castlebeck appears, says the report, to have made decisions about profitability, including shareholder returns, over and above decisions about the effective and humane delivery of assessment, treatment and rehabilitation, the serious case review found. I mean, we're also seeing here that this is actually a systematic conspiracy. The cover-up went on for years, and that the senior management were actually lying in order to make excuses for the horrific incidents that have been going on, and the police have been called to the place 29 times. So, you know, this place was an absolute hell on earth. How did it happen?
I mean, I think we've probably all seen the photographs and the videos and everything else, and it is horrific. Some of these inmates, you know, were essentially systemic torture. It was physical and mentally. And I think the problem is that we need to make sure that, you know, the most vulnerable in our society are able to go into an environment, whether it's elderly care homes or in this case, adults with learning difficulties, and we need to know that they're going to be taken care of. There's got to be a robust inspection regime, and there has to be a way to for any relatives or the residents themselves to call about an investigation. You can't have this happen.
But
again,
I mean, surely
these
this is
people
part,
aren't able to call for help themselves.
Surely this is part of what happens with privatisation, is it's out of sight, out of mind. We're paying for the service, we're paying less than we used to have to do, and so long as the service is still going on in some form, we don't actually really care. The idea being that this is now a cheaper service, and we don't have to care about it anymore because these people are running it. Now, that's surely what's happened here, isn't it?
Well, look, I mean, we need to be quite careful on this one, because there are going to be people that have relatives in private care homes. And we need to be quite clear that the vast, vast majority of private care homes provide a very good service, okay? And they shouldn't be overly concerned. But what we need to do is, when there are problems, either private or public, in these care homes, that they are spotted early and action is taken. You can't allow year upon year a conspiracy to block and cloud the issue.
But the Care Quality Commission were called several times by staff at the place to bring attention to it, and they didn't actually even bother to come and inspect it.
No, I mean, that's not a robust inspection regime. Though,
I mean, isn't
it?
I mean, the thing is that this new coalition government has actually been getting rid of these kind of quangos, like the Care Quality Commission. They've been saying,
which
oh, we don't
just
need
said
them.
Failed.
Yeah,
they were called years.
Well, surely they need
again.
To be beefed up. They need to have the staff to go
well,
and do these
to be
checks.
Properly regulated, but we can probably all agree that the Quality Care Commission didn't do its job either. Now, I'm not going to make a scapegoat of the Quality Care Commission. I would imagine they had an awful lot of things to investigate, and they probably did their best, but they massively dropped the ball here. But that doesn't excuse the fact that you had 11, well, at least 11 employees of this care home that were systemically torturing inmates. I say inmates, residents. Mm-hmm. They were treated like inmates. You need to have a robust inspection regime. You need to know that when your relative goes into these care homes, that they're going to be cared for. And you need to have a process by which you will actually have a thorough investigation for when it falls down.
I mean, for me, probably the most interesting lesson to come out of this is, if you've got friends, relatives or whatever that are in anywhere within the care system, you need to be able to actually go and see where they're living. You need to, as a friend and as a relative, actually have access to be with them for a period of time, as long as necessary, to satisfy yourself that they're being looked after properly.
Yeah, I agree.
Because this is one thing in this case, is they actually kept the relatives away, physically away from where the people were being looked after.
No, I agree. I mean, this is the problem in this specific case, and it's a bit different if you're at an elderly care home, because they can still tell you if there's something going wrong, or at least the majority of them can. You know, you get a picture. But the most vulnerable adults, that you know, the ones that have these learning difficulties, well, they're actually psychological difficulties in there as well. You might have people that are saying, oh, we're being abused, and they're not. But you've got to have a means where it's going to be thoroughly investigated and thoroughly checked. and the old system, and possibly even the current system, isn't working. It's got to be given more teeth.
Okay, our next story. Nick Clegg blocks boundary changes after the Lords reform retreat from Julie Jowett from The Guardian on Monday. The coalition government's come under its greatest strain yet after it was forced to abandon flagship constitutional reforms, and the Liberal Democrat leader accused some of his Conservative partners of betraying the mutual trust needed for the two parties to govern the country together. Now, you're a Conservative, Mark. Betraying the mutual trust needed for the two parties to govern the country.
Well, essentially, I think Clegg's throwing his toys out the pram. Look, the coalition agreement didn't actually say there would be Lords reform. The coalition agreement says they'd look at Lords reform.
They've looked at it and then they've looked away, haven't they?
Yeah, well, I personally don't think it's needed, if I'm honest, because I don't think what was on offer is actually any better than what is there.
Now, before we hear from Robin, though, quickly, let's have a listen to see what Nick Clegg had to say on this week.
After a long process, almost 2.5 years, we do not have the Commons majority needed to ensure this bill progresses through Parliament. It is obvious that the bill's opponents would now seek to inflict on it a slow death, ensuring Lords reform consumes an unacceptable amount of parliamentary time. Clearly, it would be wrong for me to allow Parliament to be manipulated in this way, not least at a time when there is so much else for us to concentrate on. So I can confirm today that we do not intend to proceed with the bill in this Parliament, and the government will make a full statement on this to Parliament as soon as it returns in September. To modernisers and campaigners, let me say this. I'm as disappointed as you that we have not delivered an elected Lords this time round. But Lords reform has always been a case of two steps forward, one step back. And my hope is that we will return to it in the next Parliament, emboldened by the overwhelming vote in favour of our bill at second reading. An unelected House of Lords flies in the face of democratic principles and public opinion. It makes a mockery of our claim to be the mother of all democracies. And even if you put all that to one side, the ever-increasing size of the Lords makes it an unsustainable chamber. It cannot keep growing. Reform cannot be forever ducked. As you know, an elected House of Lords was part of the coalition agreement, a fundamental part of the contract that keeps the coalition parties working together in the national interest. A contract not just to each other, but a set of commitments we have made collectively to the British people. My party has held to that contract, even when it meant voting for things that we found difficult. The Liberal Democrats are proving ourselves to be a mature and competent party of government, and I am proud that we have met our obligations. But the Conservative Party is not honouring the commitment to Lords reform, and as a result, part of our contract has now been broken.
Oh dear. Well, mate, doing his best to seem angry. That's Nick Clegg, leader of the Liberal Democrats. Now, Mark Weston, you're a Conservative. He's accusing you there, really, of welching on the deal, isn't he?
He is. I don't think he actually should read the coalition agreement. The deal said they'd look at Lords reform, and obviously they looked at it, and the vast majority of the colleagues didn't like it. I'll say not the vast majority, enough. Didn't like it.
Because there was a funny little blip, wasn't there, when this all happened? Because, first of all, there was a little thing on the news, someone very briefly, this is on the radio, I think, I heard saying that, well, actually, David Cameron told me to vote against it. And then there was another flip-flop, and someone else, it was basically the other direction. So there's obviously some
Chinese whispers working on this.
Yes, quite possibly. Robin, what's your thoughts about the coalition? Can it survive for the next few months? I mean, he didn't sound that angry.
It's survived for a couple of years.
And this is the thing, this is the amazing thing about this, is that if you go back into history and look at some of the small parties that held the balance of power, they managed to get exactly what they wanted because they knew that they could topple the government at any time they wanted. And Nick Clegg doesn't really seem to be really playing all his cards at all, does he?
Well, after the general election, they had the engagement, then they had the marriage in the Rose Garden in the back of Downing Street, and now it appears they're sleeping in separate beds. Frankly, it doesn't surprise me. I think that the issue that seems to have really upset Nick Clegg is Lords reform.
It's interesting that he had no problem swallowing the introduction of £9,000 tuition fees. He has no problem with the privatisation of our National Health Service. He has no problem with George Osborne's economic policies, but he has had a hissy fit because he can't get his way on Lord's reform. I think there is a deeper underlying difficulty within the coalition, which is that the Liberal Democrats are looking ahead to next year's local elections and realise that their local candidates are going to face a massive defeat as they did this year. They're thinking ahead perhaps dimly to that next general election, where I think they can become the dodo party of British politics, because I suspect they will be made extinct in the general election. And of course the Tories are feeling now, I suspect, that, well, you know, we have to throw some red meat at the backbenchers, because a few Tory backbenchers are getting very angry at what they see as the Liberals driving the car. So I've used a lot of metaphors, but in truth there is a serious point to all this, which is that, you know, whilst these people are having their spats and saying they're going to take their toys away, the truth is the economy is rudderless and we face a very, very difficult few months and few years. Will the coalition last? Well, let's hope not.
The thing that amazes me about all this is that the House of Lords these days seems to be almost like a sort of moderating, a less sort of landed gentry, which is supposed to be in the old days anyway. The sort of feudal lords used to be in the House of Lords. They seem to actually be sort of tempering some of the more, shall we say, socially unjust legislation that is coming through. Say, for example, stuff that's hitting the poor. For example, the law about criminalising squatting. When it went through the House of Lords, that was toned down a bit to make sure that it was only residential properties that where squatters would be criminalised. So why is it that I mean, maybe you're the wrong person to ask this, Mark, but why is it that they think that the Lord needs reform in any way?
The honest answer is I don't know. I think the Lords is always, it has this impression, obviously, that that's where the landed gentry sits. As long as you own a few thousand acres, you'll be in there. And it that's what it was. It's not what it is now. I think the Lords, even when, you know, on Labour government with Tony Blair, the Lords actually acted as a moderating influence. It can't stop legislation, but it can say, hold on, think again, have you got this right? And it plays that important role. I think what was on offer under the proposals that Nick Clegg seems to have favoured was you'd have a one-off election that would elect a Lord or Senator, whatever you call them, for one 15-year term. Now that's not accountable, because as soon as the person's elected, he's not allowed to face the electorate again, so he can do whatever he wants. Well, haven't actually increased accountability.
Okay, and it remains to be seen what if anything, is done about that. Right, on to some more local stuff here. The police commissioner candidate has been forced to step down, this is the Labour guy, because of an offence he committed in 1966. Labour's Bob Ashford stepped down as his party's candidate for Avon and Somerset Police and Crime Commissioner because of an offence he committed more than 40 years ago. He said, I've received confirmation of a criminal offence I committed as a 13-year-old in 1966. For which I was fined £5 and would today almost certainly not lead to a court case has now barred me from standing for the Police and Crime Commissioner post. What are your thoughts on this, Mark?
Well, actually, I mean, I know he's a totally different party. I feel sorry for him because I don't think this is right. You know, he had some hijinks when he was 13 and he got fined £5 for it. And I just think it's ridiculous. The man should be allowed to stand in the election. I think, you know, we're looking for, this is the first time that the PCC elections are taking place. I think the next time it has to be looked at saying, if you're convicted of a felony that carries jail time or something like that, because this could buy you for a misdemeanour.
Now, Robin, he says, while stepping down, I intend to fight this ruling to the highest level, not just because of the impact it's had on myself, but because this and other legislation which penalises and stigmatises children and young people who offend is fundamentally bad and discriminatory law.
I agree with that. I think that it's a ridiculous situation. If you think about all the MPs who fiddled their expenses but still sit in the House of Commons, I know they're not standing for this particular post, but all of them would not be able to sit in the House of Commons if you applied very strictly the criteria of anyone who has ever transgressed any law shouldn't stand for public office. I think that Boris Johnson and his chums at the Bullingdon Club, you know, have admitted that they used to go into restaurants and trash restaurants. Again, they probably never got criminal convictions, but nevertheless, you have to have a sense of balance here. The guy was 13 years old.
They paid for the damage, didn't they? They came along with the chequebook and paid for the damage. But John Savage has stepped into the breach. He is former, I mean, in fact, probably still the head of Business West, as well as being the chairman of the UHB, one of the big NHS trusts in the city, has announced he will be the new Labour Police Commissioner candidate. This what we have here essentially is interesting. He seems to be a more of a new Labour character. Do you know anything about him, John Savage?
Robin? I've not come across him. I tend not to have many new Labour people wanting to speak to me these days. No, don't know why. I used to be in a party called the Labour Party, but that doesn't exist anymore. It's now New Labour. But no, the there may be another agenda going on. There may be some relief in some quarters of New Labour that this other chap isn't going to stand. But, you know, I think the situation with John Savage is he'd better sort of rack his memory and think back to whether he ever sort of took any pick and mix from Woolworths when he was 10 years old. And if he did, was it caught on CCTV? Because perhaps he'll be told he can't stand in that case.
OK, and also we've had a quick swap round over the last 24 hours in the Respect candidate, Mark. What are your thoughts on that? This is for mayor, not for police crime commissioner.
Well, I'm sure there are reasons behind it. I'm afraid at the moment, I don't think any of us are truly aware of what those reasons are. Let's be honest about this. You know, we are what, 2.5 months out. This kind of swapping and changing happens. I don't know about Respect, but I just feel woefully sorry for Bob Ashford. He should have been allowed to contest the election.
And what are your thoughts on the whole business of the Police and Crime Commissioner? Do you think it was a good idea? Because this isn't something, unlike the mayor, this isn't something that we've had a choice in. There used to be a committee which is made up of various, I think, Gloucester, Bath and North East Somerset, North Somerset Council and Bristol City Council, plus some lay people, ran the police. Now it's just going to be one person.
Yeah.
The problem everyone seems to be pointing to is, what if that person is corrupt in any way? You know, like in the United States, we've had quite a lot of cases of that. These crime commissioners, this is a US system. It puts a lot of responsibility on one person, doesn't it?
It does, but yeah, the way I'd answer that is quite simply, name me the police authority. Because the police commissioner basically replaces the police authority, and I'll give you £1 if you can have if you know a single member. I'll give you £100. And the honest answer is, people don't. And these are the people that are responsible for the police service.
Yeah, but it's a spread of opinion, isn't it?
But no one knows who these people are. You need accountability. The police are on our streets.
Doug Naismith, I mean, he's an ex-MP. He's on the police authority. We've had him on here a few times talking about how much he thinks it's going to be a disaster, this new system.
No, look, if the police commissioner is corrupt, then you treat them the same way as you treat everyone else. And as far as I'm concerned, they go to court and they go to jail. Okay? But you need to have accountability. No one knows, with the exception of yourself, a new one, I know £100 to.
Who they
and no
are.
One knows who they are.
Okay, well, thanks very much. We're coming up now to the Murdoch News at 6 o'clock. Thanks very much to this week's guest. You just heard there, Conservative Councillor for Henbury, Mark Weston. After the news, the old South Bristol College site on Marksbury Road in Bedminster looks set to have its thriving local community group and all small businesses told to leave in February.